When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's Christmas, run up in our household.
Do you know what I never love?
What?
When people change the lyrics of popular songs to make them into comedy songs.
That wasn't a comedy song, that was straight bad.
No, we know. Now, it's the Christmas special of They Like to Watch, but really there's just one thing that you should be watching over the next few days.
Well, if you guys are interested, I'm going to be on the very thing we talk about this week, your television. Do you know why? I'll tell you. This is an audio medium, so you can't see the visual, but I'm using air quotes with my next word. I am on Celebrity Mastermind on Thursday.
I think that a lot of the joy people get out of watching celebrity versions of regular shows is sitting there on their asses on the sofas going, celebrities, I've never heard of any of these people. And I think you are spreading
now
joy by being,
why.
By being on that show.
So you could tune in, though, if you wanted. I had...
Well, you're not allowed to say what you had.
I'm not allowed to say how it went, but I can say what I had. I had a great time. It films in Belfast, which you may or may not know. The town is doing great. Really enjoyed walking around.
Can I say who I think the best known person is on your episode of Celebrity Mastermind?
Yes.
Roachford.
Mm-hmm.
As in cuddly toy.
How does it go again?
A cuddly toy is my only joy waiting for me when I get home, yeah. Famously, it's a song you see Alan Partridge singing at the beginning of Alpha Papa, the Alan Partridge movie.
Yeah.
What a thing. You versus Roachford.
And two other people who are my friends now.
And we can't say how you did.
No.
But
we can tell you you should watch it.
We can. And tune in to see if I now have a trophy wife.
I've always wanted to be a trophy wife.
Am I married to a mastermind? Find out. Thursday, 7 o'clock, BBC One. Shall we tell them what's happening?
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a Christmas special. And like all Christmas specials, we're throwing a lot of the festive time of year at it. But in the cold light of day, it might not be as good as a regular episode.
Yeah.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to rattle through the top 10 shows that we watch every Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to rattle through that. And if you're reaching for the stop button, halt. Because after we've done that, we have a genuinely brilliant guest.
Oh, yes. So,
and this is a Christmas treat for you. Because on Christmas Day, BBC showing an arena documentary. It's called Carolina Hearn, Queen of Comedy. And it's a film about the life of the brilliant Caroline, who created Mrs. Merton and the Royal Family and was such a talented performer and comedian and writer. And was a friend of mine.
So it was a difficult film for you to watch, I think.
Yes, and heavily featured in the film is her close collaborator, her writing partner, and also my friend, through whom I knew Caroline, Craig Cash. And Craig isn't a great one for giving interviews. Not because he's elusive like Tom Waits or anything. You know, Craig lives a good life and he knows it's all a nonsense. But it was important to Craig to be involved in this film because he wanted to make sure that Caroline's story was well told. And Craig gave us an evening, basically, to talk about the film and talk about his working relationship with the brilliant Caroline Hearn. All right then, 10 things we're going to watch this Christmas and you should too. None of these are particularly obscure.
No, this is presumably telling you shit you already know. Are we is this ranked or are we just doing it?
Oh, in no particular order.
Oh, in no particular, okay.
No okay. particular order. It's not a top 10. We're not Casey Kasem. I threw in an American reference there.
That would be such a fun dog name. For Casey Kasem. What if we
that was
our
who
dog,
did
Casey
the American
Kasem.
Chart rundowns, right?
Yeah, he was a radio man.
But for UK listeners, let's go with Bruno Brooks.
Why do they have to have an alliterative name?
Casey Kasem, Bruno Brooks. Yeah, you've got to have an alliterative name and you've got to be able to count backwards from 40.
Oh.
Which we're not. We're starting at number 10. No particular order, though. And let's start with Elf. Now, before we get into this one, I don't imagine anybody listens to this podcast with their children. If you do, what are you playing at? It's filthy.
Yeah, this is not for your kids.
Yeah. But specifically, you might want to fast forward this next bit. Because the thing at the heart of the film Elf is that Christmas is made magic by a belief in Santa.
Uh-huh.
Should we address one of the most uncomfortable things in our marriage?
What?
Our son, 5 years old, maybe 4.5 years old, says to his mum, "Mum, is Santa real? Do you want to tell them what you said?"
I have no memory of this happening, but it was obviously a big moment for you.
You said no, but don't tell the other kids. I have spent the following 2.5 years desperately trying to rebuild a belief in Santa.
Okay, so what everyone should know right now is as you listen to this, Jeff and I are going to be trying to walk this line where we're trying to keep this like funny and entertaining. But we know that if we walk onto the wrong side of the line, we will like lose hours to arguing with each other. So all I will say is I am Jewish and I mean, I'm not Jewish, but I'm Jewish. And I think it's all weird. I'm like a bit in, I love Christmas, but belief in Santa to me makes me as uncomfortable as a belief in Jesus Christ our Lord. It lives in the same box as someone being like, "Sister Sarah, come on now, we believe in the Lord, you are going to save this boy." So like I feel like I'm speaking to like a weird religious person who wants my son to hang a fucking crucifix on his wall. For me, that's my experience.
But I'm not a Christian.
You feel like a fucking said with respect. You feel like a Christian to me in those moments. You feel not even like a Christian, you feel like a religious zealot to me.
I think there's like some cultural thing going on here beyond.
I don't know if it is because I asked my friend about this and I was like, "Hey, am I weird? What are your kids up to with Santa? Because I feel like I'm dying." But Jeff says, is it Jewishness? Is it what? And she was like, it's because she is American and she goes about as hard as you do. So her take is it's growing up Jewish, but not just growing up Jewish in a very Jewish town where no everyone is the same as you. So I know I'm in the minority. I'm not trying to convince anyone. I was like, when you were so upset, I felt like I'd married this, like a religious man who was like, "Make sure our son gets down on his knees and prays and knows that he will go to hell if he ever masturbates." Like I just, that's, to me, that's who believes in Santa. Someone who also believes that Jesus died on the cross for our sins and that you are going to hell if you masturbate. It is all the same to me.
It's not.
To you.
To many non-Christian people in this country.
Sure.
They should have made you do this on the whatever that
oh
life
my God.
In the UK test
my
was.
Life in the UK test where I know how many like man-made ski slopes there are in the country. I think it's 5. But
they didn't teach you about the belief in Santa.
Like, are you like an agnostic, barely cultural Jew? Even so, you need to prep yourself for feeling extremely alienated when you have to pretend to your child that Santa is real.
Number 9. Number 9, another obscure Christmas pick. It's White Christmas with Bing Crosby.
Wasn't he like very abusive and terrible, old Bing?
I don't know that much about him. I don't think he was very nice to David Bowie when they did Little Drummer Boy together.
Yes, you told me this before. I love, basically, he sings White Christmas at the very beginning of White Christmas. And then I sleep through the rest of the film. So I watch it every year, but I have no idea really what happens. But I know that there are two sisters who sing Sisters, Sisters. And I know something happens with like an old general.
There's a lodge. Oh, the old general.
And I think his granddaughter. And other than that, I just go in and out of consciousness through the whole film every year.
High recommendation.
Number eight.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
That's a good one.
Now, we're talking about the, I think it's mid-late 60s.
Yeah, not the Jim Carrey one.
We're talking about the animated one, which I'd never seen until I got together with you. And I knew it best because it's spoofed in an episode of The Simpsons.
One of your classics. And it does, it pairs together, look out for this, fluorescent pink and a hot red. In the 60s, yes.
Also, for anyone of a certain vintage, the music in that film was done by Mr. Shirovsky from Fame, Albert Haig.
No.
You know the film Fame.
Yeah, yeah. Is he the piano teacher with the big beard?
Yes.
Oh my God, I just knew that must have been, that's what they would call that character.
Yeah, Shirovsky.
I sing the body electric.
Beautiful
sound. Number 7.
Number 7, Love Actually.
Now, the reason we got into Love Actually, so I saw it when it came out with one of my former beaus.
Oh, I saw it with an ex, yeah.
Well, but it's a given because you're never single. So there was never a point, there would not have been a point where you would have seen a film not with a girlfriend.
I remember actively disliking this film when it came out.
Well, that's because your taste has always been a little bit better than mine. Genuinely, it just has. Whereas I thought, oh, this is fun and I like the idea of the prime minister dancing and that girl at the end. I thought it was fun. And then years went by and I don't know what happened in those years. And then I think since you and I have been together, it was revealed to me that at some stage of my brother's university education, he and his friend, I mean, I don't know if this is the big reveal. Am I allowed to say on this podcast that my brother smoked pot?
I don't know. It depends whether the feds listen to the podcast.
I'm not concerned about my parents.
Don't give out his address.
But my parents for years were extremely naive about my brother's drug use. But anyway, so spoiler, because my mom would be like, because of his asthma, my mother would be like, if you ever smoke a cigarette, you will go to the hospital. And then at some point as an adult, she was saying to me, you know, if your brother ever smokes, he's going to the hospital. I was like, tell that to his fucking weed dealer. Like, what are you talking about? So spoiler, Merry Christmas, Mom. So he would get high most days, but every day he would watch Love Actually. So he has the entire film memorized to the extent that when you interviewed Richard Curtis for something at some point, you called him up to be like, hey, what weird questions about Love Actually can I ask?
And my brother, he'd noticed so many weird things whilst high.
Within a minute, he'd written you back like all these bizarre little things that you could never normally notice.
The Colin Firth's character, he falls in love with his Portuguese cleaner whilst nursing a broken heart at a holiday home in France. And I think he's writing a novel as well. And Sam had noticed that there's a stage at which all the pages of his manuscript get blown into a pond and he and this girl go swimming to retrieve them. And Sam had noticed something odd about the way they swim.
Uh-huh.
I asked Richard Curtis about this. He said, oh, yeah, that pond wasn't very deep, so they're not really swimming. They're just walking around on their knees, pretending to swim. And he couldn't believe that somebody had noticed this. And then the one that he was astounded by was, you know, that little kid towards the end of the film chases the girl he's been in the band with at school through the airport. He wants to proclaim his love for her. And then when he comes back to hug his dad, your brother had noticed the kid has got some glitter on his fingers. I say this to Richard Curtis, and it turns out there was a whole scene cut where the kid has fists full of glitter, throws them up into the air, and that scene gets cut, but continuity didn't clean his hands afterwards.
Also, what was it that Sam noticed that there was something to do with the music?
Oh, yeah. So there's a piece of, I think it's oboe music that plays.
Uh-huh.
Anytime somebody is feeling a romantic stirring. So we call it the boner music.
Uh-huh.
If you hear this music in the film Love Actually, da 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 da, it means that someone somewhere is getting an erection. I would say that I have a very good relationship with your brother. I love him.
Yeah.
He's like a brother to me.
Uh-huh.
However, when I am not in his presence, in other words, when he's at home in the States and I'm here in the UK and we're living separate lives, I would say upwards of 80% of all communication we have with each other is either directly about or in some way referencing the film Love Actually.
It's funny to me also that that would be erection music, something that sounds so romantic.
It's an oboe.
Da-na-na.
Number six,
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which I would say isn't very well known here in the UK.
No, and I made a huge mistake last year, which was that I hosted children to my house to build gingerbread houses. Like, this was my vision, was we were going to build gingerbread houses, and then everyone was going to sit on the sofa, and I'd make little candy dishes and a little popcorn dish for all the cute six-year-olds, and then they would watch Rudolph, a film that I loved from my youth. It was made in the 60s. And they thought it was so fucking boring and made such a huge mess in my living room. Oh, and I burned myself trying to glue together two parts of that. You know, you like burn sugar and that's what you use as the glue for the sides of the gingerbread house. I truly think I got a second degree burn on my hand. So I was like icing myself, getting blisters. And then these fucking children weren't watching the 1960s film that I'd put on for them.
At number five. Season 9, episode 10 of Seinfeld. The episode's name is The Strike.
The Strike? It's not...
Because there was a New York chain of bagel shops called H&H Bagels.
Yeah.
And they'd been on strike for a long time. And the industrial action is called off. And Kramer goes and gets his old job back at the bagel shop. But that's not what makes it a seasonal favourite.
It's Festivus for the rest of us!
Which is one of the writers, Dan O'Keefe, his dad refused to acknowledge Christmas and so came up with his own holiday called Festivus.
And it's for the rest of us. Do you remember the rituals of Festivus?
There's the metal pole rather than the Christmas, the aluminium pole. And there is the... the airing of the grievances. And the feats of strength, which sees George Costanza wrestling his father.
You know what? Actually, to bring this back to our regular pod, we've had a few people write in saying, I'm sharing my shame. Like, I know I'm supposed to love Seinfeld, but it's sort of not working for me. And I completely understand that. And I respect it. I might say to you guys, I'm not convinced this will do anything for you. But if you're at a loose end across the next week, try Festivus for the rest of us and see if it does anything for you in terms of unlocking it slightly.
Also, I said that the main plot of that is Kramer and the strike. In that same episode, there is another very famous Seinfeld plot, which is about Jerry dating the girl who looks amazing, unless she's in bad lighting.
Oh my God, I know that has been said about me at different points.
She's a two-face.
I am a two-face.
You're not a two-face.
I'm big hands, I got man hands, and I got two faces.
Oh, and Bryan Cranston's in it.
Oh my God, Seinfeld, so dense.
As Tim Watley, so the dentist.
So yeah. Much happens in one episode.
Number four,
When Harry Met Sally.
This is a big classic for us. But you didn't get into it until you met me, correct?
Yeah, I'd seen it, but it wasn't part of my Christmas. I'm still not convinced it's a Christmassy film, but it has got a great New Year's Eve scene in it.
It's the big end. And it's 100% a Christmas film.
Every year, I'm amazed not only by the dialogue. I mean, some of the observations about men and women are a little dated.
Yeah, sure.
But the way that it's such a conversation-heavy film, it's such a script-heavy film. So what they do is, you know, that cliche about, well, New York is a character in itself. Mm-hmm. I do think it's true of that film because mm-hmm. the locations that they set them in, be it a ball game, be it bringing a Christmas tree back, be it a bookshop, it just really gives it such pace as a film.
And there's very funny power walking in it. Billy Crystal's power walking is some of the funniest shit he's ever done.
There is one thing that happens in our house every year without fail when we watch this film.
I fall asleep.
Nope.
I talk about how thin she looks when she does the karaoke machine at Sharper Image.
Oh, you do that, but that isn't what I was thinking of.
Go on.
You always feel the need to point out that when they're leaving Chicago, right at the beginning of the film, to drive to New York, that they're actually driving in the wrong direction.
Basically, they're heading south. It makes no sense. It's one of those things that you wouldn't be driving into the city if their starting point is the University of Chicago, which is south of the city. Makes no sense.
You love to tell me that.
I love to mention it.
At number three,
it's another obscure little film called It's a Wonderful Life.
This is one that you brought into my life, baby.
I've seen this film at the cinema every year since 1992, apart from one year during COVID.
Yeah, we couldn't go in 2020.
Only in the last couple of years did I discover that one of my cousins also loves this film. Mm-hmm. And I feel that every year when we see it, I have any number of pithy little observations that you are sick of hearing.
Uh-huh.
So it was a joy to discover that this cousin of mine also loves it so that I could then text them to her.
Yes.
And I will now read you some of the quirky things I've noticed about It's a Wonderful Life.
Great.
This will mean nothing to you if you don't know the film. Okay. Do you think it's a bit weird that Mr. Gower gets a telegram saying that his son's dead and then lights up a cigar? So understand that when people are in times of real stress, that maybe they're smoking cigarettes. But the cigar seems like an odd choice to me.
My boy has been born.
When we first see Sam Wainwright as a kid on the ice, he's saying, hee-haw. He really sticks with it at Harry's prom, on the phone from New York, when the Martinis move into their new home, in his telegram, hee-haw, every time. I think we've covered 30 years there. Who's using the same catchphrase over and over again?
Who's using a fucking catchphrase?
Next thought, Annie could probably get a lot of money for her divorce fund by suing Harry Bailey for sexual harassment.
Totally. He grabs her bottom.
Next one. When she throws the rock, Mary definitely wishes that none of George's dreams will ever come true.
Yeah, you that's a big one for you talking about.
Okay. Oh, an opinion. Hot take.
Uh-huh.
George's biggest mistake is continuing to employ Uncle Billy in a position of financial responsibility. He's clearly in the intermediate stages of dementia and allows animals to run amok all over the building alone.
I wouldn't give him my money.
Nick, the barman.
Yes.
His life would have been better if George had never been born. As we see when they go in the bar with Clarence, he is the proprietor of a thriving night spot with a diverse clientele, whereas in the version where George had been born, he's just a jobbing barman in Giuseppe Martini's bar.
It's good.
They should take away Bert the cop's badge for firing a handgun across a busy street full of pedestrians to stop an unarmed fleeing man. And Bailey Park.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
here?
Yeah, Bailey Park.
In the Clarence timeline, where George hasn't been born,
yeah.
Is a graveyard.
Yeah.
So does that mean that in the real timeline, George had to exhume bodies to build there?
Uh-huh. Okay.
You're visibly stifling a yawn.
It lost momentum for me, if I'm being completely direct with you.
I felt I really built up to the Bailey Park graveyard.
Yes, I think you did do that. And I bet with good reason. But just for me, some of the earlier ones were a little bit more dynamic.
Number two.
Mm-hmm.
A Christmas Story.
Oh, yes.
Again, people in the UK don't know this.
Oh, it's so fun. It's when is it set? I know it was made in 1983. That's when it came out. But I think it's like set in the 40s. And it's about this young boy who wants a BB gun. And it's just so fun. And I really recommend it. And it has a great sense of humor and a little bit of heart. And it's set in the Midwest of the US of A.
I like it.
You don't like it. And you won't admit that you don't like it.
No, I like it.
And it's fucking funny.
I think it's got some genuinely funny bits in it. It also has the air of a boomer's Facebook post who's like, remember the good old days when you could leave your back door open and the worst thing that had happened is a neighbor would pop in to say howdy?
It's a really fun film. Just watch it. There's like a really sweet little boy.
Remember the good old days when the only screens we had were screen doors on the back door?
I agree
with
that point.
So a neighbor could pop in and say howdy?
I agree with that point.
It's got a touch of that to it.
I don't mind. I wish I lived in a stage where it was just screen doors.
The little boy, Ralphie, also has a cameo in Elf.
Yes, I knew that. Peter Billingsley, isn't that his name?
Oh, I don't know.
He has the bluest blue eyes.
Number one!
And at number one, Muppet Christmas Carol.
That's one we make sure to always see at the cinema.
And
here it comes. Here's what he's going to say. I know what he's going to say. Say your big thing that you like to say.
No, you think I'm going to say, it's amazing how Michael Caine
That is
performs
what
as if
say.
He's not performing. I wasn't going to, as if he's not performing with Muppets, as if he's on stage at the RSC or something.
One of Jeff's favorite talking points.
But no,
this time
I wasn't going to say that. I wasn't going to mention
No
Cheeses for Us Mises.
No Cheeses for Us Mises.
I was going to say,
how I am Miss Piggy.
Yes, you really consider Miss Piggy a soul sister.
I do. And I said to Jeff, because this comes up like, I don't mean to be obnoxious or center myself in too many things, but you don't understand how often I get told I'm like Miss Piggy. And when I was at college, I had this roommate and she was like, you're basically Miss Piggy. And I'm like, you basically just told me I'm a pig. And she was like, excuse me, have you ever looked at Miss Piggy's body? It is banging. And I was like, oh, okay, fair point.
She isn't the Muppet I'd want to fuck, though.
No, she, this is what I'm saying. She's not. You want to fuck Janet.
Janice,
whatever.
From the Electric Mayhem.
Yeah. Exactly. Miss Piggy isn't fuckable. And what is my value if I'm not fuckable? It's all I've ever wanted to be.
All right, those are the 10 things we will be watching this Christmas. And coming up next, Craig Cash, my friend, talking about our friend, Caroline Ahern, his comedy partner and collaborator, subject of a new film, Arena, Caroline Ahern, Queen of Comedy, which is showing on BBC Two on Christmas Day. I owe a lot to them.
Don't cry.
I'm not going to cry.
It's not appropriate for Christmas.
We all started in local radio. And when we were all eventually fired from local radio, they were just starting doing the Mrs. Merton show. And they made a job up for me. They gave me a job out of pity.
Mm-hmm.
And that job was to be there on the days they recorded and to make sure that Caroline had had exactly the right amount of Asti Spumanti before she went on set.
Because too little and she wasn't loose enough and too much and she was out of control.
Oh, yes. Craig Cash is coming up next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I've got something here that I want to show you. It's a piece of art.
Oh, yeah.
That you sent me in the mid to late 90s. Can you see that?
Let me have a look. Where's my glove? They're on my bloody head. Let's have a look.
It's a drawing of a penile shaft and a scrotal sac inside Mrs. Merton's friendship book.
God, it was a great book, that. I really enjoyed writing that.
Have you ever known anybody spend as much time drawing penises and scrotums as you and Caroline? It isn't the traditional route to success, is it?
No, it's not. But it was amusing. Actually, you'll see it. You'll see in the documentary that we're about to talk about Caroline. You'll see a photograph of us both, and in between our shoulders in the background on a whiteboard is a giant phallic symbol as well. Which what we used to do, we used to have, and I did it one time for Caroline, and she would have me doing it every time we had executives coming down to meet us or from wherever, and she would say, "Do the you've got a diagram about this, haven't you, Craig?" And it would be, so I would say, "Right, here's how we see the year going," and I'd be going like, "I see it," and I'd like a draw. It'd be a slight upturn here, and then we'd go up and up, and then we'd just end up drawing cock and balls, and Caroline would just be, and that would be lunch then.
But what's surprising to me, though, I hear so many writers, they'll talk about the process of the work, and like you're chiseling away and you're trying to perfect something. And It seemed like you would just laugh a lot, and then somehow at the end of the day there'd be some lines or a scene or something.
Yeah, well, we would. Yeah, we would spend a lot of time laughing, and then we'd say, well, first of all, we'd try and do anything but work. I'd come around and, you know, invariably at Caroline's, because she'd throw, you know, she'd say, oh, I don't feel that well today, like every other day of the year. And so we'd go around and then she'd say, oh, let's just put a bit of, Loose Women on or whatever, anything, any excuse not to work. And after all that, we'd talk about what we watched on the telly the night before, and then she'd say, oh, I've taped something for you, Cassie, you're going to look. I said, no, come on, we've got to start working now. But then you know, we would craft things later. You know, when we started writing, we'd put it off, a bit like homework or whatever, and we'd put it off, and then we'd hit on an idea, and then it would all come out in a big mad whirl. We'd be shouting at each other, and this is what she'd say, he'd say, and we're back and two, and then we'd write it all up, and then we'd kind of go over it and over it and over it to a massive degree. And weirdly, I was talking to somebody the other day who didn't quite understand what I meant, but if somebody sounded like they were written, we'd rewrite it, because we hate it whenever on telly, and it happens so much that you can tell a script is written and it doesn't feel kind of natural, you know. So if we did wrote something that felt a bit written or a bit smart or a bit clever, a bit like somebody wouldn't think of in the spur of the moment, we'd rewrite it. So we'd rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until it didn't feel written. That's weird, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course I do. Because, you know, it's the thing, and it comes up in the documentary. Central to Caroline and you is real life is funnier. If you think about the things that have made you laugh the most in your life, it wasn't a well-crafted piece of television. It was time you spent with friends or a funny colleague.
Yeah, they were always the bits that kind of interested us, really. And we would think, people are enough. If you observe them and strip them back and let them do their own thing, people will recognise that in themselves. And I think that's what happened to a large extent. But not kind of... We didn't expect it to do as well as it did, Royal Family, but because we thought we were writing something that made us laugh. It was always, it all came about with, well, we were doing Miss, I think I described this in the documentary, we were doing Mrs. Merton. I didn't want to stop doing Mrs. Merton because we were kind of earning money from it for the first time, as you know. You knew me when I was totally broke, Jeff.
I do, and then all of a sudden I had a friend I could borrow money off.
Everyone's dream.
But yeah, so she was saying, I want to do something else, let's do a sitcom, but not like a sitcom, like our lives, like, because she'd love it. Every day she'd ask me to tell the story about what my dad had said, or just like normal everyday nonsense that we would find funny.
And also, what seems extraordinary to me now, all these years later, is you're just absolutely sure of yourselves. Like, you knew what you thought was good and you knew what you thought wasn't. And nobody was going to persuade you otherwise of that. So a lot of people, if they go in to pitch to a producer or an executive, you know, they will say anything to get something made. And you and Caroline, you had this strange confidence about what it was that you wanted to do, which is
I think the confidence
funny.
Came I think that probably the confidence came from each other, and a kind of trust in each other that we made each other laugh. But Caroline was more certain than me that it would travel a bit further than just me and her. We were on a kind of a banker with the Mrs. Merton show, and we'd just got a mortgage and all that other nonsense of real life. That I needed more persuading. But once Caroline said, no, I'm not doing it anymore, I'm sick of getting that wig stuck on my head and blah, 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 or, you know. So once I knew that character was over, then, you know, we just threw everything into Royal Family, yeah.
I didn't realize until I watched the documentary that... the Mrs. Merton audience was the same every week.
Yeah.
How did you go about finding those specific people to be your weekly audience?
Well, we did. We had a few ideas of who they might be. We wanted to. It was important for us to kind of feel like a family on set, really. So we started with like friends and family, older people, like Caroline's mum's in there, my wife Steph's dad and mum were in there. Jeff, you were in the audience, weren't you, several times in the early days?
And his ex-girlfriend, thank you very much.
You didn't point her out, did you, Jeff?
He's a serial monogamist, Craig, you know, so it's going to be some ladies dating next to him, obviously. He's not just going to go with a friend.
Did you see him stroking her, holding hands with her and all, Sarah? Very sickly, wasn't it?
I was very nervous because I was in the pilot. Because Craig and Caroline thought I looked like a vegetarian because I had these little roundy glasses.
Of course.
So they said, will you be a vegetarian? But I was very nervous.
Oh, and is that why you were holding her hand all the time?
Yeah, also because I'm a codependent person.
Yeah,
emotionally codependent. But my grandma was in the audience on Mrs. Merton with her boyfriend, Vic.
How long was Mrs. Merton on for?
Oh, I don't know. I think we did four series. So,
wow.
So, about 3 or 4 years, I think.
And when Caroline says to you, like, I'm done, I don't want to wear the wig anymore, are you like...
Gutted.
You're not sort of thinking this sucks and I'm enjoying the money, but this woman is kind of a genius and I trust her, so here we go. Or were you angry with her? I think that's my question. Were you angry at her and worried she was self-destructing?
No, well, I could see it coming for a while that she wasn't too, because it was stressful for her. You know, she was front and center. Mm. She had to go out and carry it. We shot it as live. Nothing was set up about it, so I did feel a little bit towards the end of the third series that. A bit like a kind of a second in a boxer's corner. Like I was kind of pushing her, you know, pushing her out to fight another round. And I did feel that after a bit. So I kind of acquiesced. But at the time it was like, you know, I had a mortgage and everything. I think I was getting a new kitchen, all this. And I was like, whoa, come on. Hey, you know, we were quids in. I was like, forget the Formica worktop, love, we're having granite. And then Caroline had come in and go, I'm not sure I can do it again. I'll be going home going, whoa, what are you doing with that granite? What's wrong with Formica? I'd be like that. You know, come on, whoa, lads, put that granite down. So there was a bit of kind of, but I knew in my heart. And then as we kind of discussed it while we were doing the series, I kind of knew. It was basically because we were broke, and Caroline has a weird relationship with money in that she never really wanted any of it. She always give it away.
She was the most insanely generous person.
Why? But why didn't she want any of it? I mean, did it make her feel too far away from herself or something?
Possibly. I've never really, I don't know. I think she got a lot of pleasure out of, you could never tell her you liked anything in front of her because she would just buy it, you know, and then you'd be what have you done that for? But I don't know. I guess she never saw much need for it. She lived a dead simple life, really. All she wanted was the telly. The biggest telly possible. Yeah, and
I remember getting a telly once where you could watch two channels at the same time, anybody would want to do that.
She probably would have done. Absolutely lived for the telly.
Because Jeff and I can get into this thing where he'll talk all the time about like how the TV was like the sixth member of his family and it was always on da 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 da. And this, like, I feel sometimes becomes your defense for there just being like incessant screen time. Whereas my feeling is like, you know.
No, it's my culture.
It's your culture. I'm like, but these were not.
It's our culture, isn't it,
these
Craig?
These weren't iPads. These weren't games.
No, it's our culture.
And now I realize Caroline is to blame for the fact that you don't mind unlimited screen time.
This is what they basically hit upon with the royal family, is if you go to a middle-class person's house, the first first thing they do is turn the telly off so you can have a conversation. Whereas in a working class house, the telly is the central point,
yes, but my point
around
is,
which the conversation
is that
orbits.
Television was so much better for you than the shit that's out there now. Is
I would
I
sit and watch the test card. I would leave pages from CFAX.
I remember, you know, that thing you said, Jeff, about turning the telly off, posh people turning the telly off when people come around and working class people leave it on. Yeah. I remember I was very young at the time, and my elder brother brought his kind of boss home, and it was all kind of ooh, and but the telly was on and they came round and everything, but my dad, who's basically his Jim Royle, was still like watching the telly but trying to put on airs and graces, and my mum said, turn that telly off, Jim, and the whole family went what's my mum's lost her mind? I mean, he's important, this fella, but come on, mum.
Oh, can I ask one Mrs. Merton question before we move on?
Yeah.
So we when you had Bernard Manning on, I never heard of, who for our international listeners is a very racist English comedian. Is that
an
a fair
old
way?
70s an old comedian. School... He was on TV a lot back in the day. And as Caroline said in the documentary, his timing, his way of telling a joke and his sort of comic persona was extremely funny, but it was horrible, racist. You know, his excuse was, I'll make a joke about anyone, me. But it had a real nastiness to it.
So you talk about this in the documentary, which is really interesting, and I was wondering, like, what happened after? Like, what were the goodbyes like, and where did he go? And did people have to, like, sit and be nice and chatty and small talky with him?
No. He left immediately, and it was kind of extremely frosty, you might say. And he kind of exited quickly, I think. But there was a weird air to floating around for ages after that show finished. It was kind of very strange.
Because I can't remember there being much tension. It seemed to be after that show, even people who didn't quite know what they were letting themselves in for tended to go back up to that green room and have a drink. And it tended to be a good atmosphere after those recordings.
Oh, yeah, we had great fun.
Do you remember Joe Brand was on the show once? And at the time, you and Caroline, I was in my early 20s, and Caroline and Craig were very intrigued by the fact that I was a young man who had developed hemorrhoids.
Uh-huh, sure.
So there'd be these drinks after the show. And and Caroline says, Jeff, come over here. Joe used to be a nurse. Show her your piles. You can check them. She used to be a nurse. So I dropped my trousers and underpants in this room BBC in Manchester and showed Joe Brand, the comedian, my bum. And she said, yeah, I used to be a psychiatric nurse.
Oh, dear me. She still had a good look, though, didn't
she? Yeah.
Something it's when she got that torch out, though. No need for that. We used to have right fun after. It was fun in them days. I think back now. And the same, really, with the royal family when we did that. We wanted to everybody to feel like they were having a good time doing the show. We wanted to make it like it was good fun for them. Loads of times me and Caroline would be rowing on set and what have you.
You didn't bottle stuff up.
Oh, no.
Didn't sweep stuff under the carpet.
Oh, no, we'd never do that. We'd have countless rows. We'd lose days for having a row, and Caroline would go in a mood. Then I'd think, well, I did go a bit far, didn't I? So I'd have to go and knock on a dressing room door. Hey, listen, I'm sorry. And then, depending on what level of mood she ended up in, you know, we might lose an hour to half a day. And it might be me, you know, it's not just her. And she'd be coming round saying, oh, Cassie, I'm sorry, I went too far. But one time we were filming an ill-fated series, Mrs. Merton and Malcolm, where I was playing a hapless son, Malcolm, and we had this Buffy scene, and there was like it was a funeral for Mrs. Merton's husband, and we had this spread out on a table, And during the shoot, the scene, the shot, I got a piece of malt loaf off the table and started eating it. I know it wasn't my lines or anything coming up, so I was eating it. I knew I was in shot, but and then I put it down, and then we cut or something. Caroline said, "Don't eat malt loaf, Cashy, on the thingy." So I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Malcolm wouldn't eat, never eat malt loaf," and I've gone, "You what? Malcolm wouldn't eat malt loaf." But really, she thought I just wanted to eat the malt loaf that was there, fancied it, and I was just starving and wanted to eat the bloody malt loaf. But she put it to me in such a way that Malcolm wouldn't eat malt loaf. And I was like, "Yeah, have a word with yourself. What do you mean? A character wouldn't eat malt loaf? You idiot. What are you talking about?" And it escalated and escalated. Uh-huh. And then we ended up losing half a day over it because this row continued over this piece of malt loaf. We lost half a day's filming. But the truth is, I actually did want the malt loaf. I did. I was just hungry, but I couldn't concede the argument. But anyway,
this is illuminating because I think when we interviewed Mark Mylod, who went on to direct Succession, talking about how he was the director on the Royal Family, and I'm sure that those types of high tension moments about artistic choices that the characters were making really set him up for Brian Cox and Jeremy Strong and the method acting on Succession.
Mark was instrumental in how the Royal Family was shot, because we shot the pilot for it multi-camera and we didn't like it, and he came along and he set the visual grammar for it. Really, the camera shouldn't be above certain height, it should be handheld, it's like a documentary, kind of unsung hero on it. I mean, you know, Caroline and myself learnt so much from him. It is absolutely no surprise that he's gone on to, you know, much, much bigger things.
A thing that Jeff has said about you and Caroline was that, like, if he ever puts a toe over the line of taking himself too seriously, he knows he's going to be made fun of by you for that. There is a zero tolerance policy for that kind of thing.
And especially anything emotional, like Caroline was like the all-seeing eye. So if I was ever on like some rubbish TV show at 1 o'clock in the morning, Caroline would be the one person who'd see it and text me taking the piss out of it.
I remember.
Also, I did an interview. I know what you're going to say. I did an interview. Me and Chris Addison did an interview about how we became friends, and we were both quite sincere in it. And if I didn't get a barrage,
you didn't make
of texts,
that mistake, did you, Jeff?
A barrage of text message from Caroline taking the piss out of me for daring to show any kind of genuine emotion in a public forum.
But so then what was so interesting to me is when I started watching The Royal Family, which I only did when I met Jeff and he spoke about it in these really glowing terms, is it had so much more emotion in it than I was ready for based on the way he sort of described you and Caroline. And I wanted you to explain to me how these two parts go together.
Well, you can't. Well, it, one thing, doing it on telly, showing emotion is fine, but in real life, you can't be sincere like that. Fancy that. I guess it might be Is it a northern thing? Is it?
I don't like it in comedy usually. Like, so a lot of sitcoms that people recommend to us to watch on this podcast, I will watch, and there's just something cloying about it, or it's got sentimentality in it. But there's a line I think you managed to walk in Early Doors and The Royal Family that isn't that kind of cloying.
I think it's you always kind of got to pull back or undercut it with a line that kind of lifts it out of that sentimentality, really. If you use it sparingly, it can work really well. But especially sort of in The Royal Family, because they were working class of that era, and you would never, growing up, my dad would never say, "I love you." I mean, with my kids, I say, "I love you" all the time or whatever. But in them days, if I said that to my dad, he'd think I'd bumped the car or something, you know, he was just not spoken.
Would your dad hug you?
No, I don't think he'd hug me.
Oh my god.
I don't think hugs hadn't come in the early 70s. We only ever shook hands on Christmas morning to be happy Christmas, quite civil. But no, hugs were, no. I don't know how I feel about that either now, to be honest with you.
Meaning it makes you...
Well, I don't know whether it was a good thing or a bad thing.
This is what's so funny to me is that these, like, you guys with your, like, 70s Northern fathers, like, I don't know if it was a good thing. I was like, I think it's bad.
Yeah, but we turned like it out, but we can hug our kids.
Yes, no. Like, but it wouldn't, it's amazing. I think it's really interesting and I don't know why it is. Like something shifted and I don't know, but it just, wouldn't it just unequivocally, or whatever that word is, just be better if both of your dads had been like, hey, I really love you. And here's like, that wouldn't have made you like a soppy piece of shit. It just would have been nice, right?
Yeah, but I do think I knew my dad loved me.
Yes.
It's just it wasn't sort of demonstrated like you, you would do these days.
It wasn't verbalized or demonstrated.
It wasn't what?
It wasn't verbalized or demonstrated. You just had to like believe in it. Like, it was very intangible.
Yeah, I didn't. Honestly, I wouldn't. I mean, no, he never actually said it, but I'm sure he did. But he only lived till he was 88, so he probably didn't have time. Oh, no.
I once had a therapist tell me that an emotionally absent father is... often linked to an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. Have you got any thoughts on that, Craig?
But Craig doesn't, this is my read. Knowing, you know, most stuff I know about you, I know it's like stories that Jeff tells me. I think Craig has an acceptable relationship with alcohol.
Well, I don't know. I think I do. I mean, all the issues that Cameron... I think this is touched on in the documentary as well, when she was diagnosed as alcoholic. You know, who am I to argue with the Priory or whoever? But I still kind of don't think she was, you know. Honestly, that's an awful admission. And I don't want anybody to think, oh, he's misguided, that fool. You know, they knew better. But I mean, she liked to drink. You know, we both did. I still do. But that's just because I'm still here. Caroline will be, I'm sure, probably listening to this in heaven with 20 Bensons and a bottle of wine on the go and thinking, God, blimey. Listen then to have you, she'd be fascinated with the bollocks that we're talking about her. But I much more agree with a diagnosis of bipolar. I can 100% confirm that would be a more accurate diagnosis. Maybe she was both. What did you think, Jeff, of Caroline and the drinking days? I'm just going to pour myself a glass of wine while you... I just want to get you.
Get a mood.
I think a bit like with me, like when Caroline was fine, more than me, actually. But Caroline was such a fun person to be around when she'd had a drink. I mean, she was a fun person to be around. But I think Caroline had her demons. And when those demons are flaring up, the worst thing you can do is pour alcohol in, you know?
Yeah.
And I got the impression that she was drinking in a much healthier way, you know, knowing what her own red flags were, if you know what I mean.
Well, toward the end of her life, she was hardly drinking at all. The bipolar diagnosis must have been like a light going on in her head and going, wow, yeah, that is me. My understanding of the condition is that they're massive peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
And with therapy and medication, the peaks don't go as high and the troughs don't go as low. And she genuinely did hardly drink at all. It was so disappointing. No.
But that's, you know what, though?
I'm joking.
They used to come in and go, we drink because we're nervous. And we're nervous all the time.
I don't know. May I, as far as Caroline's concerned, you know, we like to drink, we like to have a laugh. And at the end of the the day or a long, hard day or week or whatever. I guess it was that culture. And they go on about it in the press picked up on a drinking because of the awards dues. And we go down to the awards dues. And I say in the documentary, we'd get on the train in Stockport, we'd be pissed by Macclesfield. And we were. We'd just have big fun and alcohol always played a part of it. And maybe stupidly, I've never discouraged my kids from drinking alcohol because some of the best times in my life have been with a drink in my hand. To this day, I still don't know whether Caroline had a bad relationship with alcohol or not.
But part of it is also when people become famous, the press likes to have a word that they can put in front of them. Trouble genius, Caroline.
Yeah.
People are just much more three-dimensional than that. And that's what's interesting in a way about watching a film about somebody you know, and obviously for you it's much more intense because you were as close as two people can be. Like you see them, but you never quite see them in a 360-degree way. It's
yeah,
a good film. It tells
true,
the story of a life, but it's never quite three-dimensional.
Yeah, that's true. Papers do that, don't they? And I think it's harder being a woman as well, especially. Press intrusion was terrible back then, and then they'd blow it all up. We were going to London absolutely giddy with life and having fun, and we thought, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Double standards, really, isn't it? A woman can't be seen to be having good fun and falling over occasionally.
The bipolar thing explains somebody's depression, but I really believe that with Caroline, that the press intrusion fueled her unhappiness. I remember like just rotten times where they'd be camping outside her mum's house and pushing notes through the door, and
yeah,
that really affected her. And whatever underlying depression was, maybe that wouldn't have got as bad, or the episodes wouldn't have been as bad as they were if the press weren't having a feast on it.
No, they certainly wouldn't have been. It threw petrol on a fire. You know, they were sifting through her bins. But she was daft because she'd read the papers and stuff. But she read the papers anyway. She'd buy more or less every paper every day.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, well, what are you reading the papers for? And she said, well, I can't just stop reading them when it comes to the bit about me, can I? And that's intriguing and this, that and the other. But
yeah.
The media lapped her up, and I can see why. She was a barrel of laughs. She was good fun.
I didn't hear from her so much in the last couple of years of her life, but it does feel that being back home and living a quieter life was suiting her well.
Yeah, it was. And she was back in Manchester. She was, you know, in London. Was crackers time for her, really, I think.
Do you remember when she lived next door to Jason Donovan and it was driving
her
mad?
He
was playing his music too loud.
Too loud, yeah. But she had this acute hearing because she had the problem with her eyesight, I think. She had this retinoblastoma, this cancer of her eye, so her vision was limited. Her earring was kind of like Wonder Woman's earring.
Oh,
and so anybody, I'd go around to write with her in Manchester and she'd be like, they've got the strimmers on. They're strimming again. Why does anybody need to strim a garden? What's up with these people? And I'd be going, well, just ignore it. Don't pay attention. Don't pay attention to it, Cassie. Have you heard it? And I'd go, hang on. And they'd be like dead air for a second. I'd be going, yeah, but it's not that annoying, is it? You're annoying me now. Bloody hell.
There's sort of a strong sense that she wasn't suited to the fame.
Yeah.
And it seems genuine that it wasn't right for her.
No, I don't think the fame was. I think she was gratified by the public acknowledgement of her work being good and worthy and awards or whatever. I think, you know, but she was shy, really. You know, she was, when she got to know her, like Jeff did, she was a barrel of laughs and good fun, but she would never be, you know, extrovert, show off. She was pretty kind of shy and always embarrassing, never did interviews because she just felt a bit embarrassed by them. You know, why would I be talking about myself and stuff?
Although I thought that was something that was really obvious in the documentary is they didn't have that much of her just talking to go off. So there was her on Michael Parkinson. You saw her doing a bit of stand-up on herself. And that was another one of these things where I'm thinking she was so funny, like just so, like often with comedians, you can feel disappointed when you meet them because they can be quite sort of dry or introspective or whatever. Whereas I think like Caroline, I mean, she was many things, but she's like relentlessly funny and just being herself as well.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that's not, I mean, it's captured obviously in memories of people who loved her, but it's not captured anywhere in quite the same way.
No, I don't know whether she'd want that either. That's a kind of private side to her. But really, yeah, she just was funny. Everything, you couldn't walk through the door without taking the piss out of whatever you were wearing or whatever, you know, if you'd had a new haircut. She'd just be like ripping you to pieces. She was extremely great company, weren't she, Jeff?
Biggest heart.
Yeah, she was good fun.
Yeah.
Craig, I was saying to Jeff, we were talking about this, and I was saying, like, very weirdly, and I don't know why, after Jeff's mom died, I noticed that, like, the place she was for me was at the end of the train platform at Manchester Piccadilly. For no apparent, like, I was never there with her. She didn't even really live in Manchester. But when I'm there, like, I take a morning train back from Manchester, and it'll be like 7 a.m. and kind of empty. And I'll just be like, this is where she is now. This is like, I'll maybe say a thing to her if I'm there. And I was wondering if there's like a place where Caroline feels like she is for you more than another place.
Well, that's weird. When I took over doing Gogglebox from her in this very room where we are now, which is a cupboard under my stairs. And when we used to do it from Manchester, and I took over from her when she was ill doing the chemo and stuff, I would sit in for her. And then she died, and I'm still doing it. And I used to go in there and think, really feel like there's I could still see her in the same room, and it would be like hello before I began the show, which sounds a bit kind of nutty now, but that was a kind of a place, that studio. But to be honest with you, she's kind of everywhere with me and always in the back of my head, and always I'm thinking. And you know, when I was watching The Banshees of Inisherin last year in the cinema, and just thinking, God, blimey. Well, I watched it on my own. I can't remember where Steph, my wife, was. And when I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, Steph would love this. And I was thinking, oh, Caroline would love it. But I knew I could tell Steph to go and watch it, which she did, and did love it. But I couldn't tell Caroline, and it broke my heart. Mm-hmm. So I see her everywhere and think about her all the time, and what she would be thinking if she saw this. But it's just so sad that she was taken so young. It's like the boy's birthday, my son's birthdays, and any special occasions and stuff. But so she's never really far from my mind at any given time. But I would say that studio in Manchester, which is still there, was a place I'd used to go in and felt she was with me. And I think it kind of, this just sounds so soppy, you would have cut this out. It was kind of like, it felt like she was kind of helping me get over a loss a bit, you know, as if she was in there saying it's okay. That's so sad, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway.
But also nice.
Christmas Day it's on, isn't it, BBC Two?
It's on Christmas Day, BBC Two, Christmas Day. I think 9 o'clock, something. She would have been 60 on Christmas Eve, though.
Yeah.
So it will be a particularly sad one this year, because she would have made such a wicked older woman, wouldn't she, Jeff?
Yeah. Have you changed your aunt's phone message to the little boy who Santa Claus forgot this? Yeah, Craig, he used to do that every Christmas.
I did. And Fairy Tale of New York. That's particularly poignant this year, isn't it? She won't. You know what? She rang me up one time, at about 2:30 in the morning, and I was in Manchester. She was in London, and that's no, that was no strange thing, you know, being woken up by a legless somewhere. But this time she said, "Cassie, I'm with somebody who you love, Shane McGowan, and another fella." And I went, "What? Shane McGowan? No chance." She said, "Yeah, honestly, I'll put him on." You know what she was like, weren't she? Have anybody. One time she rang me up and said, "I've got George Michael massaging my feet, Cassie. I'll put him on." And I'm like, "What do I say to George Michael?" And he was like, I said, "So she's massaging your feet?" "Yeah." And I didn't know what to say because I thought, it's George Michael. What does, I liked Wham or whatever. And it was like, still the conversation. And she put her back on. But this one time, about 2:30 in the morning, she rings me and it's Shane McGowan, this other bloke. I said, "Oh, wait, put him on." And I said, "You're not Shane McGowan, are you?" And he was like, I said, "Sing me Fairy Tale of New York." Because I was really suspect that he wasn't. She was just winding me up. And he just went, "It was Christmas Eve. I'm the Hares." I was two in the morning. I was like nudging the missus. Steph, Shane McGowan.
Oh,
the Hares
God.
On the back of my neck. And I said, "Who's the other bloke?" He said, "I don't know, put him on." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "Nick Cave." "You're not Nick Cave, are you?" And he went, "Yeah." I said, "Sing me." I said, "No ways are you Nick Cave." And I didn't know they knew each other that well.
Can I guess what song you asked him to sing?
The ship song. Correct.
Yes.
I did. I said, "Sing with the ship song." Yeah. And he went, "Come sail your ships." And I was like, "Oh, honest to God, I had an early morning erection." I had a 2 a.m. instead of 9 a.m. erection that morning.
Very hard for me now because I want to say something gushing about Craig, but what if he was to hear it?
Well, but and then he would mock you for that.
Yeah.
But maybe it'd be okay because you didn't say it to his face.
Caroline would mock me from beyond the grave.
Yep. Maybe she's in the sweet heavens looking down at you and laughing at you. Not with you, but at you.
And on the subject of things to watch at Christmas, aside from this film, Caroline Ahern, Queen of Comedy, I would say that the Queen of Sheba episode of The Royal Family is, I'm struggling to think of another example of the Christmas special possibly being the finest episode of something.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, look who's back for Christmas.
Hello, everybody.
It's Mr. Inbox, who himself was inspired by a character from the film Elf.
Mr. Narwhal. Ho, ho, ho. How long do I have to do it for?
I think that's plenty.
Okay. This first email comes from John Brown. Dearest FC and NC, you asked about hobbies we took up after watching a series. I'm embarrassed to say that I bought a chess set and started playing with a friend of mine after watching The Queen's Gambit. John Brown, I think that's super, super sweet. As we mentioned, I'm learning very, very slowly. And I'm a big fan of the game.
Although a rook has gone missing.
What do you do? This is a real question. What do you do if you have like a not total piece of shit chessboard with not total piece of shit pieces and one thing goes missing? How do you replace it?
It feels excessive to replace the entire chess set.
Yeah. So would someone please tell us what to do to replace a rook? Thank you so much.
Can you get spares?
Yeah, spare rooks for a nice board. Firecrotch, he continues. I remember during the Succession days, you saying how you couldn't fancy Kieran Culkin or Matthew McFadyen as they were quote unquote wife guys. The phrase wife guy is a guy who's like too into his wife. Now, I want to go back on this. You have to remember, anything I say, you should never, ever listen to. Especially if it was on the Succession podcast, because we were very overworked on that podcast. So
is that a mea culpa?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A wife guy, here's a wife guy, ready? A wife guy is a really successful guy who's married to a really beautiful woman who isn't as accomplished in her own right. And they're living their life, the successful guy with the beautiful woman who has like whatever fucking hobby she has. And then the guy is insistent on communicating to us, no, seriously, here's why she's so special. That's a fucking wife guy. No, she really, her charity work really is extra special. Shut up. be the rich, famous guy with the gorgeous, hot wife, but don't make me think you're anything other than a cliche. That to me is wife guy. I'm not sure I'm even using the term correctly. Now he goes on. However, I think it's rather lovely how sweet and devoted Normcore is with you.
I am sweet.
Were you actually negging Jeff when you said that?
She was pegging me when she said that.
Oh my God, I don't feel the desire to peg you.
I don't feel the desire to be pegged.
I mean, I would respect it if you did, but I just don't want to like explore your body.
I don't want to be explored in that way.
We don't want to probe each other. Yeah, no. We've got our moves. We'll stick to them. I will get around to joining your Patreon next year. I'm so sorry I haven't yet. Oh my gosh, John, don't even worry about it. But other people fucking join that shit. I want the money. Come on, you know that I do. But of course, we're all affected by the Kazi lives. And also, I don't want to condone Sarah's plans for surgery because in the words of Andrew Lincoln in Love Actually, to me, you are perfect.
John. Is this really from your brother writing under a pseudonym? I mean, that sounds like a pseudonym, John Brown. It sounds like a made up name.
John, are you flirting with
me? I'm not going to go with John Smith. I'm going to go with something more interesting than John Smith.
Wait, what if he's flirting with me? I mean, I'm spoken for, but I still want the attention.
John, stop cuckolding me on
John,
my own podcast.
If you met me in person and you saw me in the wrong lighting, you'd be repulsed by me. But if you saw me in the right lighting, you'd be like, you're cute. I have a saucy way about me. Keep up the great work. Love your podcast. Thank you, John. We love you.
How nice that you left in the compliment.
Of course I left in the... That's your fucking thing where you edit out the compliment. If I got a guy flirting with me, you should fucking know about it. You're probably not flirting with me, John, but if you are, I'm here for it, you little bitch.
This comes from Catherine Ross, who says, Dear FC and NC, I've just listened to last week's episode, including Chloe's email request for Netflix Christmas movie rankings, and I realized my calling. Based on Chloe saying her time was cheap, I think we might be on the same wavelength. So I have provided this public service.
Can I interrupt you here? So what Catherine actually did was she wrote this list of all these films, which we are now going to include for everyone. On our Patreon this week, she also put in these like really, really useful and funny and excellent descriptions. We couldn't just sit there and read the descriptions of like 14 films for you. So for all of our Patreon supporters, you are going to get a detailed breakdown of all these films that none of us have ever heard of, so that there's a little bit more context for you choosing which one you might watch.
She says, I've left out the classics because people already know about those. Also, we've just exhausted those in the first half of this podcast. And instead focused on the lesser known 10 a penny Christmas movies that have proliferated on streaming services in the last couple of years. Ready?
Ready.
So she breaks them up into three tiers. Top tier. Sit down to watch with a mug of hot chocolate and tree lights are twinkling. Mm. This is Christmas on Now TV and Noel on Disney Plus. Second tier, watch while wrapping presents or decorating the tree. You're not going to need to concentrate too hard, but your heart cockles will be warmed. The Princess Switch, Netflix. The Christmas Prince, Netflix. 12 Dates of Christmas, Disney Plus. Falling for Christmas, Netflix. Holidate, Netflix. Holiday in the Wild, Netflix. Third tier.
I'm just laughing because she's watched all these films.
She just really loves
I
Christmas.
I love it, Catherine.
Third tier, avoid at all costs. Your Christmas, mine too. I hope this helps. Merry Christmas and thank you for all your televisual recommendations this year. You are welcome, Catherine. All the best to you and yours and your kin.
And again, a breakdown of all those films and what they're about will be on the Patreon. You could join us £3 a month. Our last email is a follow-up from Josh Moritz. He wrote in last week, Josh is the one where we're trying to make a Christmas miracle happen, where he described those shows and he wanted you guys to maybe help him figure out what they were. Well, you failed. Fucking fine. I don't even give a shit. But Josh is who we thought saw us in the park. And so we had said, we hope we looked adorable. And this is what Josh wrote. Dear Sarah and Jeff, it was me you saw in the park. Uh-huh. We knew it. I think you both projected an energy that was approachable, but also busy. That is so me. I'm approachable, but I'm so busy. I think I'm always walking around looking like that. So that on the very rare occasion that I am spotted for my pod, someone will be like, God, she's busy, but also approachable. It seemed that you were in the depths of some kind of concentrated logistical discussion. Oh my God. I mean, you really got the measure of the woman. I'll tell you, you really got the measure of her. But not too much to not smile politely and acknowledge unknown passersby. I was trying to project the energy of a delighted and pleased fan with respectful boundaries. Merry Hanukkah. Happy Christmas. Love, Josh. Josh, thank you for letting me know that I come across exactly the way I intend.
I think you come across like that when you're out on your own as well.
I can still serve busy.
Mm.
Yep.
I think I look like a man who lost his job months ago, but still leaves the house and pretends he's going to work and then just shuffles around the streets not quite knowing what to do with himself.
Whereas I think I project like a bizarrely dressed Fortune 500 CEO. Don't you think?
Like on the way to do undercover boss.
Yes, yes. That's what we're giving you.
Still time to send us a Christmas e-card as well as your recommendations.
Fuck off at firecrotchandnormcore.com. Are we doing harmonies or am I singing on my own?
I don't think anyone needs to hear me.
Oh, I think it's better when we harmonize. I have a burp. Hummus-y. I had a very good hummus earlier. I'm just finding my truth. Hold on. Christmas truth.
I don't know what's going to come out of your hair.
It always comes out. I always do the same. Oh, no, I'm going plot twist. Plot twist, right turn. I saw mommy kissing Santa Claus.
I wonder if the plot shouldn't have twisted and should have just continued in a straight line.
Silver bells, silver bells. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding a ling a ling a ling. Let's hear those sleigh bells ring a ling, ding 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 a ling.
It's a medley.
Maybe it's over now.
Okay. And the remaining 35 minutes of that medley will be available to our Patreon supporters.
No, it won't. Okay. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
And a happy up your butt. Bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.